Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange. I'm Colin Robertson, your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. Today's episode is part two of my discussion on the aftermath of the 2019 federal election with John Manley, Kathleen Monk, and Carol Taylor. It was taped at a luncheon held at the Fairmont Vancouver on October 24th. John Manley is chair of the CJAI Advisory Council, and he previously served as a member of Parliament and Cabinet Minister holding various positions, including the industry, foreign affairs, and finance portfolios, as well as serving as Deputy Prime Minister. Until recently, he led the Business Council of Canada as their CEO, and he is now a senior business advisor at Bennett Jones. Kathleen Monk is a member of the CJAI Advisory Council, and she has served as a journalist and then senior political advisor. She is now a principal at the Ernst Cliff Strategy Group. Carol Taylor is a distinguished former broadcaster and then served as an elected legislator as finance minister in the British Columbia government. She is the former chancellor of Simon Fraser University and current chancellor of Victoria University at the University of Toronto. She is also chair of the Trilateral Commission.
In 1990, Pierre Trudeau, the height of constitutional discussions around Charlottetown and Meech, had been in China, and he came out, and I had posted at our commission in Hong Kong, and the commissioner wasn't going to get anywhere near Mr. Trudeau at that point because he was a bit like Darth Vader. So I had to fly in a typhoon, and I spent the next couple of days with him. I was posted in Hong Kong, and he was there with Justin and Sasha, and I saw Trudeau the father, which is very different from Trudeau the prime minister, but I had time to talk to him, and he said to me, prime ministers have three big files, and we've talked about the first couple. The first, of course, is national security, which is both economic and defense. The second one is national unity, which we've just guided. The third one is Canada-US relations, and I've had the opportunity to talk to subsequent prime ministers, and they've all said, yes, those are the three big files that a prime minister has to carry on their desk. Now, we talked about Canada and competitiveness in the world, but we haven't so much talked about Canada-US relations, so I'd be interested in managing Donald Trump remains, and I think this was probably something that Mr. Trudeau, in my view, did pretty well the last few years. The critical issue was the renegotiation of our preferred access, and we're not through it yet because the Congress hasn't passed the legislation, but I'd be interested in the panel's view on the critical relationships, U.S., but I also would be interested in China, because I think China, as we know, with Meng Wanzhou and our two hostages.
It's interesting, and when you're thinking about just a pivot off that, when you're talking about the Western alienation, how to fix that problem, I think the previous Liberal government, was quite smart in their appointment of Dominic Barton in going into China. And so they almost need to have someone for the West who's almost as unassailable as Barton was, right, for that position.
Although Mr. Scheer had some views, which I thought were really silly. Why would you pull this man out who's got this extraordinary network?
Right. But regarding the U.S. and Canada relationship, I thought, like you, Colin, I think the government was very effective in 2017 in reorientating the government and cabinet towards that U.S. relationship and negotiating NAFTA with not only the U.S.-Canada war room, a whole restructure of cabinet, and with Freeland really championing that relationship. We have to wait to see that deal come back, as you say, from the U.S., and I know now in a minority parliament, you're going to see parties like the one I used to work for, the New Democrats, fighting still for inclusion of more environmental legislation in that, not stopping the deal, but we'll still
Nancy
work
Pelosi
for that.
Nancy Pelosi may help us out on that.
That's right. She may do the hard work for us, which will be good. In terms of China, I suggested this last night, and I'll just repeat myself, so forgive me for those in the room who heard me last night. I think that it's probably really important that Canada reorientates its relationship with China as well, in the same way, with the same focus and tenacity that they did with the U.S. relationship. They need to do that with China to mend those relationships quickly, and I think that should be kind of one of the few top priorities. From a perspective, you know, Freeland has been, a New Democratic perspective, Freeland has been very good at championing Canada as kind of a promoter of our multilateral institutions. New Democrats embrace that vision as well, particularly our involvement in things like the Arctic Council. We just elected a young woman in the north in Nunavut, and so our focus on that in those climate-affected regions of the world will be one of importance going forward.
John and Carol, I'd like you to Canada, U.S., Canada, China, but Canada and the Pacific. My good friend Stuart Beck's here, who's the leader of the Asia-Pacific Foundation, and I give a shout-out to a publication which he introduced me to yesterday, which I looked at this morning, called Asia Watch. You can sign up to it for free, folks. So there's my pitch for John. You also serve on the one of the Asia Pacific Advisory Councils. How do we manage these big international relationships? And here we are, of course, on the Pacific Rim. So U.S., yes, but also a bit on the Pacific.
Well, I guess first, kudos to the Prime Minister for his management of Donald Trump. As I said to Ambassador McNaughton one day, I don't know how he holds his breakfast down when he goes into those meetings with the President of the United States. And it's an odd time, to be sure. And we came out of it okay, given some of the rhetoric and hostility that was directed toward Canada of all countries. I mean, just to remind you, our steel and aluminum exports to the United States were charged an important tariff in order to protect U.S. national security. I mean, this is totally bizarre stuff, but I think we've managed through it, and I give them full credit for that. And I totally agree with Kathleen. Our role in international organizations is an important. I almost say it's from my time as foreign minister. That's the cornerstone of Canadian foreign policy is multilateralism. And I would say we need it now more than we ever needed it before. Because when you think of Canadian history, we basically grew up under the umbrella of the United Kingdom. And that was true through World War II. You know, we declared when the United Kingdom's at war, as it was in World War I, and again in World War II, we were at war. World War II wasn't quite automatic. Mackenzie King, the wily fellow that he was, waited a week just to say, we're Canada, we'll probably go, but we're going to think about it a week until we declared war, September 7th, 1939. After the war, we moved under a different umbrella, and that was that of the United States. NATO, NORAD, Canada-U.S. defense relationships. If we could paper the walls with the rhetoric that was used by visiting presidents to prime ministers from 1945 onward, that would cover quite a lot of space. It all sounds great and warm. My thesis, Colin, is that we are now more than ever alone in the world. We cannot expect the America First policy to go away. It's permanent. Doesn't matter who wins the 2020 election. America First is there to stay. What does a Canada First policy look like? And I would say, looks a lot like multilateralism because we need all those relationships and friendships that we can develop around the world. It also means engagement. Mature countries engage with countries that they do not agree with. It's the only way to have dialogue. And where I'm not giving kudos is our foreign minister can't go to Russia. We can't talk to the Saudi kingdom. We're on bad times with China. Even though, man, when nobody was dealing with communist China, we were feeding them in the Great March Forward, which was a great step backwards in China in the 1950s. And Diefenbaker was prime minister and authorized the sale of wheat to China. This is crazy for Canada. And so I think we need to move very assertively to once again be what you would know as a former diplomat, calling the useful country. You know, we could go into rooms where the Americans were not welcome, and then we could go and tell the Americans what happened in the room. We were able to build bridges. We were able to do things that because we were Canada. And that doesn't leave us a lot of room for pointing fingers and hectoring other countries about their practices. It doesn't mean that we have to agree with them or endorse them. They don't call it diplomacy for nothing. You actually do need to be diplomatic.
Carol, we sit here on the Pacific Rim, to British Columbia in particular. This is, if we are serious about trade diversification, it starts here and goes, although that also includes getting our resources here so we can then ship them out.
I was going to say to John, you take China, I'll take the U.S. Obviously, we've got big, big issues with our foreign policy, and you didn't even mention India. So we've got real complications. And to get back to being a respectable player in the world, I think we've got to get the politicians out of it and go back to our public service and the strong diplomatic corps that we had and the people who are really foreign affairs thinkers to start putting the pieces together with other countries again. But when it's just the politicians playing games, whether we walk into China and say, we'll only talk to you if you put gender equity on the table, you know, we have to wake up and be more sensible because we have to deal with all kinds of cultures around the world. So with the U.S., I'm not worried about that relationship. It's too strong, too permanent. We've got families back and forth. A recent study asked, they did it in 1991, and they said to the various provinces, what province do you connect with the most? And so BC said Alberta, and Alberta said BC. They asked the same question this year, and BC said Washington State, and Alberta said Saskatchewan.
This was the Angus Reid poll you're
Yeah. And so I think, and you'll find it in Atlantic Canada too, so much of our trade, our movement, it's north-south. And so we have a Trump for the moment. We may have a Trump again, but our governors work together. Our people work together. Our businesses, our universities work together. So I think that's a strong relationship. But with China, we've got serious issues. And as John mentioned, that's the world I grew up in. You know, we were in China, right? Canada was there. We were good friends. Nobody else was. We were. I've had reason in the last couple of years to do some traveling in Asia and was astounded from other Asian countries, their worries about China. And it started to make me think a little bit differently. But then what's happened to Canada in this past year has shown us a side of China that is not good, that really is harmful. It's harmful to our relationship. It's hard to understand for the long term how we move forward. But just to take two Canadian hostages and to cut off canola and meats and because they felt like doing it has made, I think, many Canadians wake up to, oh, this is it's certainly a significant power, but it may not be a benign power. We better be careful.
All right, I want to open this up to the floor, and both Adam and John have got microphones, and I'm going to take two or three questions, but they will be questions, please.
My name is Klaus Schmidt. I'm from the German consulate.
Yes.
You didn't discuss the question of a reform of the electoral system in Canada, which was definitely an aspect in this election.
No, that's
maybe you can elaborate on this a little
thank
bit.
Thank you. Yeah. That was a planted question, actually. No.
Thank you. But a question over here. So electoral reform, which was, of course, a
I'm
promise
sure
from
us.
I thought there was one over here.
Oh, yes. Okay, here we go.
You talk about Western alienation. I grew up in Quebec and an Anglo. Talking to my Quebec friends, and I asked them, what are you missing? And the answers they gave weren't very good, and we could always deconstruct it. You mentioned Western alienation, but you don't talk about what it is. What is it, aside from a voice, that's missing, specifically?
Okay, fair point. That one, let's start off. Electoral reform, is it on life support or simply gone?
So as a policy idea, New Democrats will continue to champion reform as we have for many previous elections. While it seemed in many ways there was a bit more of a sentiment and people, you know, we New Democrats traditionally get stuck in this, or at least since 1993, have kind of gotten stuck in this strategic vote conundrum towards the ends of elections. In the last 2 weeks, the end game messaging tends to turn about the boogeyman of the Conservative Party and come vote for Liberal. There seemed a moment in this campaign that New Democrats might have been able to outsmart that and encourage Canadians to vote with their hearts and vote what they truly wanted in the hopes that, you know, future electoral reform would happen. But the pessimist, cynicist in me says, I don't see it going anywhere. I don't see, you know, potentially with Conservatives now seeing the value of them getting the popular vote higher than the Liberals. But truthfully, most studies show that if we had some form of proportional representation, that the Conservatives would almost never form government in this country just because there's that swath of, you know, around 60% of Canadians that vote progressive. So I can't see the Conservatives championing it, and the Liberals killed it in 2015. You'll still hear active voices, both from that community of policy wonks that want that idea and from New Democrats and probably from Greens that will continue.
Carol, I'm going to turn to you on the Western alienation. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, Scott Moser defined clearly the pipeline reform of equalization. And what was this, the third?
But
the pipeline, yes, building the pipeline.
So to your question, you know, it's not a focused answer. And I think that's why it's been building for the past few years. We can't say there was one thing, but there are things like there are comments about our forestry industry is in terrible shape in BC. And families are suffering all over the province. Jobs are being lost. And there's a sense that, well, if that had been happening in Quebec, something would have been done about it. And with SNC-Lavalin, for instance, a lot of people, they may not publicly say it, but they say, there we go again. There's the government that is Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal. That government is going to save a company that has been accused of corruption around the world and also within Canada. And they will bend the laws or push justice or do whatever to look after that company. Would they have done the same for one of the oil companies? Or would they have done the same thing for companies out west? Would they even know about some of the stresses? So I think what it is little things have been building. The pipelines, killing the northern pipeline and even eastern pipeline, but also putting in regulations on top of regulations that make it almost impossible to build any infrastructure, and to not have Ottawa realize that. And I know from a competitive and productivity point of view, some of the recent taxes that Mr. Morneau did, for instance, on corporations, I was at his first meeting after his budget and Trump had just done all the cuts. And so, of course, one of the questions to him was, well, you know, we're losing our competitive edge here. And he said, no, it's fine because now our rates are about the same as the states, which is missing the whole point, which is we pile on regulations, we've got complications with First Nations, we've got a very active environmental community. So building it all in Canada and in the West, which is where we're talking about, is just getting almost impossible. And Jason Kenney will point to all the companies that are just giving up and leaving because of these policies that apparently Ottawa thinks are fine, but they're really hurting places like Alberta. So it's not one thing, but we're not represented in their government in a way that seems relevant to the West. And someone said to me the other day, there'll be no one from the West who's going to be prime minister because we're not bilingual enough. And so we're not at the heads of organizations back east, and all the heads are back east. And so there's just a feeling like, you know, we're kind of floating out here, and we've got some problems that they don't seem to care about.
John, electoral reform and Western alienation?
I get both. I agree with what Carol just said, largely on the alienation point, but I'd also add, you know, the number of people that understand how equalization works would not occupy much of this room.
That's right.
And I kind of think that in Calgary, at least, they believe that, you know, where beside the Palliser Hotel there, where the railroad tracks are, I kind of think they believe that CP
is loading up money.
Loads money into rail cars there. And chugs across the country and unloads it in Montreal.
Doesn't it?
So I'm here to tell you, equalization is a federal program. Federal money comes from all provinces in Canada. About half of it comes from Ontario. So the largest contributor to equalization is Ontario. It's actually not Alberta. Alberta is a significant net contributor, but all of the country contributes to equalization. And the purpose of the program is to ensure that there's a basic minimum level of services provided across Canada for all Canadians. It's a very complex formula with, I forget, 40 or 50 different variables that go into it to measure fiscal capacity. I don't know whether that is a message that can be communicated and whether it's still got the adherence of most Canadians as it did. It's actually included in the 1982 Constitution. So very hard to, the formula itself is not in, but the principle is in. And whether there's a way to work around that to reduce some of the antagonism, I'm not sure. It would certainly be improved if Quebec and Premier Legault has stated this as his objective. If Quebec ceased to be a recipient of equalization, that would take a lot of the sting out of this. Now, unusual things are happening in that part of the country. When in my lifetime, I've never seen a case where Ontario admired Quebec's fiscal situation and Quebec admired Toronto's hockey team. But it's happening. So I actually think there's something there that needs to be dealt with. Otherwise, I agree with what Carol said. On the electoral reform issue, it's a really good question. And of course, Germany is an example of a country that has made it work. Problem that we have here is that we really have no political tradition of coalition governments. And you heard Prime Minister Trudeau yesterday saying he wasn't thinking of a formal or an informal coalition. We just haven't really, other than during World War I, we have not had coalition governments in Canada. And the political culture is not, it would have to learn it. And it would also require a little bit more adherence among parties. There are pros and cons. There are different methods, but fundamentally, I'd say this. When I was growing up, I never played very much in the way of organized sports, but played lots of sandlot sports. So, you know, you always agree on the rules among the people playing. So, you know, you agree before you start. If you hit the ball over Mr. Brown's fence, is that a home run or is it just a a double because you got to stop and everybody's got to climb over the fence and get the ball back. And after all, in politics, there are some things that you really need to get all the players to agree on. And I actually cut the government some slack on their reneging on their promise on electoral reform because you couldn't get consensus. The New Democrats and the Greens want proportional representation. It would help them. So not surprising that they would want it. The Liberals actually wanted what the Australian system is, which is an assigned or a ranked ballot. Why? Because that would help them, because they're usually everybody's, if not first, then second choice. The Conservatives are quite happy with first past the post because that's how they actually managed to win and form governments. Now, the Liberals could have come in and said that we promised it, we're going to do it. They could have followed the New Zealand model, which was a two-stage referendum to get there. That might have been a way to manage the broken promise issue. But fundamentally, there's no consensus among Canadian political parties about what to do. And every time, it seems, with the exception of Prince Edward Island, who voted in favor of a proportional representation, this province voted against it. And when these ideas are put forward, very often Canadians say, you know, actually, we kind of like the system we've got. And even though it's inefficient in a way, and you say, oh, yeah, but look at the popular vote, it seems like Canadians know when they want to throw somebody out, they do, as they've elected Conservative and Liberal majority governments in the last decade. When they've had enough, they find a way. So I don't know if it's broken or not. I don't accept the rhetoric that your vote doesn't count if your candidate didn't win. That seems to me a perversion of the democratic principle. But I don't think there's a pathway to getting there unless somebody's willing to hold a referendum on it.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
Oh, yeah, one here.
Okay,
yeah,
please.
Table one,
go ahead.
Thank you very much. It's more of a comment than a question. My name is Nurjahan Mawani, and I have had the honor of serving the Aga Khan and the Aga Khan Development Network in Afghanistan, and I've just returned. So thank you. This has been a very interesting panel. My point was to bring in on the Canada First discussion, or the point that was made by Minister Manley and Colin, is how do we leverage a huge Canadian asset, which is its diversity. And I think the way we do it now, at least my observation, both from being part of Canadian government and being now having been abroad, is that we sort of stumble along as opposed to, we know it's the right thing to do, but I have not seen a sort of a strategic approach to this. So as I look at multilateralism and I look at Canada First, how can we contribute in a much more effective way through using and leveraging our diversity?
Thank you, Nurjahan. No, the diversity question. Do I have another question?
Please, right here. My name is Mina Lawden. I'm actually in the forest sector, but my question is related to the question we just heard, and I just wanted to offer a perspective on it. I have my Twitter obsession, obviously, during the campaign, but the one tweet that stuck with me was reporter Althea Raj of Huffington Post. She tweeted that she was on the NDP campaign for 2 days, and already twice she'd been mistaken for Jagmeet Singh's wife, which also highlighted for me the challenge of diversity. Mm-hmm. So I just want to kind of dovetail off that question.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. All right, well,
there is one there.
There's one
Sorry.
More. Last, and then the final
Center
question.
Table.
Great comments. Thank you very much. Elizabeth Modell with the Downtown Surrey Business Improvement Association. I'd like to know your input and what your thoughts are around electronic voting and technology and moving us forward to an online system where more Canadians will vote, particularly the millennials.
Thank you. All right, we've got diversity and online voting, which is an interesting sort of perspective.
Yeah, for
Why
sure.
Why don't you start off on the online voting? Because you've...
Can I grab the diversity first?
You can grab the diversity.
Because, the New York Times may quibble with you. The New York Times has a headline today. All right, so Justin Trudeau, and I didn't read the full article, but I got a sense of it, which was that, right, Justin Trudeau won, but can Canada please stop calling itself diverse paradise because it's just not, was the sentiment.
We're not a paradise, we're not diverse?
I think it's the diverse part. And I think it speaks to Mina's question or comment, really, relating to that, you know, there were also a lot of questions about representation, which we're clearly failing on this panel today. today in terms of diversity, but also representation in terms of the press gallery and how they navigated in dealing with the responses around to some of the scandals that were raised around the blackface thing and how to deal with that. There was this photo that was circulated excessively on Twitter, back to the Twitter obsession, about the press gallery and just frankly how undiverse the press gallery in Ottawa is. That they always do tend to be a bit of a bubble, but I think it was highlighted more so in this campaign. Just quickly though, on the underlying point of your question beyond diversity about the multilateralism, New Democrats and generally I agree with Liberals that multilateralism will continue to be a way where we can re-strengthen our position in the world, especially because we are, as John has said, kind of floating without kind of linking ourselves as we have historically to the UK or more currently to the US. And so it's through those institutions, like whether it's the UN, as I mentioned, the Arctic Council, the Francophonie, to increase our presence there and show that we are helpful
and
engaging.
Be useful, as John said.
Pardon?
Be useful.
Be useful. Yeah, elbow grease sometimes, right? Yeah. Get into the arena. In terms of electronic voting, just quickly before I pass it on to my colleagues, I would rather, as a first step, I sit on the board of Civics Canada, which is an incredible organization, close to this organization, but a very different mandate, which is around student democracy and the student vote. In this past election, we reached close to 1.5 million students across Canada and educated them on the civic process and actually got them voting from grade 5 classes onwards. It's a really incredible program that teaches teachers, and the teachers go into the classroom and they roll out the curriculum. And as I said, there was close to 1.5 million students, I think, that participated this year. I would rather, so that's part, I think, to get people voting. It's not necessarily through technology, which is my roundabout way of answering that. It's about understanding the civic process. And I think that Elections Canada can do even more than it's already done in recent election campaigns to make the voting hours more flexible and more convenient to Canadians. I resist going towards technology and electronic voting for, not that I'm anti-data or anti-technology, I just have been in situations, particularly leadership campaigns, that have been organized through electronic voting, and we were DOSed, and it was a disaster, and, you know, we were, you know, literally those things happen, right? And yes, there can be security measures around it, but I actually think that there is, and maybe this is, I think that there is something psychological to the benefit of walking into your community center, your local church, or your local school, or wherever it is, and having that community experience. I think that's fundamentally important. Every day I make a point of talking to my neighbors back in Ottawa, and I actually think it's a revolutionary act because they all say we stop talking to our neighbors now. We don't know them as well. So I say rebel against that. Talk to your neighbors, vote in person, bring your kids, bring your dog, whatever you need to. But that would be my take on that.
As we go forward, I'm going to, because I'm conscious of time and yep. John has a plane to catch, I'm going to ask my last question, and feel free to opt to comment further on diversity and the electronic. But my last question to you all, and I'll start with you, Carol, is what are you reading and what would you recommend that the leaders and the new members of Parliament read?
Okay, then. What I am reading, and I'm not far enough in to know whether it's going to be a good book or not, but it was recommended by my friend Tom Jenkins, who started Open Text. You would know of his firm. Anyway, he said, Carol, you absolutely have to read it. It's called 12 Rules to Good Life or Living, something like that. And it says it's an antidote to chaos. And so I'm just starting into rule number one, and I'll see where it goes. But he felt that it was a really important book. It was by Jordan Peterson, who is controversial for sure.
Yes. And would you recommend leaders and to this be more widely read then?
Can I tell you when I'm halfway through?
Please.
I'll see how it goes.
Okay. John.
I was going to borrow.
You can steal my book.
She brought
totally.
A book, so I'm reading, what is this called? I've been reading Chief Justice McLaughlin's autobio,
yeah.
Which is called Truth Be Told.
Okay.
Which is kind of an interesting, as a lawyer,
yes.
It's particularly interesting, but she's got a really interesting background and a great achiever, so I've been enjoying that. And what would I ask for a new member of parliament to read? Almost anything to learn about civics. You have no idea how low the common base of knowledge
right.
is. When people arrive in parliament, they don't actually realize that there are constitutional limits, that municipalities have their own area of government, provinces have theirs. Mm. Oh, man, I mean, a little bit of constitutional and civics knowledge. But I agree with Kathleen, by the way, because you invited us to comment
yes.
on the other things, on electronic voting. Now, I have to say, I am an early adopter of technology. You know this,
yes.
Colin.
Yeah, he was the first person with BlackBerry in cabinet.
For sure
yes.
he was, yeah.
But I have two fears about going to electronic voting. One is the one that Kathleen's mentioned, that it's a big technology project. And big technology projects, especially ones run by government, often go haywire.
Think of Phoenix.
Think of the Phoenix pay system yes. as an example. There's a verb in Ottawa called, have you been Phoenixed?
So true.
Yeah. Some people get extra money, and then they don't know when it's going to be taken back. Some people, anyway. I have the thought of a general election in Canada going haywire. And, of course, the second fear is cybersecurity.
Yes.
So, it's pretty old-fashioned, but when you think of how efficient we were, we all trudged into our polling stations, marked our ballots with pencils, dropped them in boxes. They were counted within 20 minutes of the polls closing. The numbers all added up. And away we go. That's a pretty amazing thing. Now, if you want to increase voter turnout, again, agreeing with Kathleen, but very specifically, I would move voting day to Sunday, okay. when it makes it a lot easier for people to get out and vote at the polls. And it's worked pretty well in France, and I don't see any reason why we couldn't do it here.
Kathleen, you get the last word before I ask
Suzanne. Okay, quickly, I'm going to cheat and give three books. One, which is not published in Canada yet, so it's for 2020, could be on that reading list. It's Thomas Piketty's latest version, which is
Inequality.
Yeah, exactly, okay. Capitalism and Ideology. So that's coming out next year in Canada. It's already out in France, so if you can read French, grab it there. I am currently reading, so this is the Trudeau formula, The Seduction and Betrayal in an Age of Discontent. It's a really interesting book, so I recommend that. And then
who wrote it?
This is by Martin Lucas, who's an investigative journalist based out of Montreal. The book that is one that I've read in the past, but really should be read by everyone, is Thomas Frank's. Thomas Frank is a great political writer from the U.S. You may have read What's the Matter with Kansas and others.
Yeah.
But his book from 2016 called Listen Liberal, fantastic. So I would suggest that as well.
I'm now going to ask Susanna Pierce, who is a member of the CGI board and who was instrumental in bringing together today, to come up and deliver sort of the closing remarks. Manly, Monk, and Taylor.
Manly, Monk, and Taylor. I like the sound of that. And I wanted to thank all of you for joining us here today. I might mention that I was just in Victoria this morning for the legislation that was drawn for the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. So I do want to say thank you to the Coast Salish people, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh, for hosting us here today and enabling us to have this wonderful conversation. And I know for many of you, you might look around the room and go, wait a minute, did I get the special ticket? What happened? You are in a special situation here. And the reason for that is because you care enough about Canadian global affairs to be here for lunch. And one of the reasons I joined this organization, in part because I've known Colin for many, many years, more than I care to tell you, is because I believe, as Canadians, we don't care enough about Canadian global affairs. I see our consul generals here from the Netherlands and from England. Wonderful to see you here today as well. But we do need to care, because Canada is not punching where it needs to punch. And we can. The investment that I had the privilege to be a part of, the LNG Canada project, our CEO here is here today too, was the largest single private investment in Canadian history. It was extremely difficult, but we got it done. And there is a formula to doing that. But I am very worried that if we don't care about Canadian global affairs and our role in global affairs and whether we compete, we will not see another one of these. And our economy and our country desperately needs it. We need it for our children, we need it to manage our deficits, and we definitely need it for our Indigenous people. So thank you for making the time here today. Please remember this organization. This is the first, but not the last. Spread the word, because Canadian global affairs matters as much in BC as it does in Ottawa, and let's make sure the rest of BC understands that. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode, part two of a series taped in Vancouver after the federal election. Remember, you can find the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, or wherever else podcasts are found. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating on iTunes. It helps the podcast grow. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI, and thanks go out to our producers, Jared Maltay and Jay Rankin, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.